Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
My new book, Diary of a Psychosis, is out. It's the most lively, devastating baseball bat to the throat takedown of what the public health establishment did in 2020 and beyond that you can imagine. It's my first book in 9 years, and you're going to love it. Check it out at diaryofcovid.com. And if you've already bought it, make sure also to visit diaryofcovid.com so you can claim your free bonuses, including my free companion volume, Collateral Damage, a collection of stories from real people who suffered under the restrictions. They weren't allowed to tell their stories at the time, but every one of them told me, "We just want to be heard." Check it all out at diaryofcovid.com. Hey, everybody, welcome to episode number 2,444 of the Tom Woods Show. I don't know what I feel like I have to prove here still, but here we are, and I'm delighted to be joined once again by our old friend David Ramsey Steele. And some of you may know him, of course, from being previously on the Tom Woods Show, but even beyond that, I think probably, David, the book you're best known for is the book From Marx to Mises, Post-Capitalist Society and the Challenge of Economic Calculation. Is it safe to say that?
Yes.
Okay.
Very safe. Yes.
Well, today we're going to be talking about things that are quite unsafe. We've got some very challenging topics indeed to keep us, to sink our teeth into today, because David is on the verge of releasing yet another book, this one with the rather unusual title, The Conquistador with His Pants Down, and the subtitle is David Ramsey Steele's Legendary Lost Lectures. So, David, welcome back. Glad to have you.
Yeah, glad to be here.
So, I'm going to ask what anybody asks with a collection of essays. I've released them. I've read and enjoyed many collections of essays, or in this case, derived from lectures. Sometimes they're just a bunch of things that have been published in obscure places, and you want to have another book to your credit, you throw them all in there. But there does seem to be, through these varying topics, an interesting thread running through them all. What would you say that is?
I would say that that's very percipient of you to have spotted that. And I think...
Well, thank you.
When I put this together, it was just a collection of some of my recent stuff. But on reflection, there is a dominant theme. There are several dominant themes, but one theme is that we live in a point in time where old religions are somewhat enfeebled, like Christianity and Islam and Judaism, but where new religions like global warming and transgenderism are extremely powerful. And these new religions, they all appeal to science. They all claim to be scientific. And my view is that I'm a sort of rationalist freethinker going way back, like Voltaire and people like that, that we have to recognize that the enemy of progress is no longer the theology and the theistical supernaturalist religions, but it's the modern scientific religions, which of course are pseudoscientific. They're not genuine science, but they have many of the qualities of religions, and they're at least as dangerous today as the old religions.
Well, let's try to unpack why it is that people would be drawn to what you're describing as new religions or delusions of one sort or another. And so that's going to take me into, as a segue, into the essay you have in there about Scott Adams, we all know as the creator of Dilbert, yes, and as a controversial commentator and as an analyst of the Trump phenomenon. And he is known for arguing that facts don't matter. And by that, he means, in general, that persuasion doesn't necessarily succeed because you have more facts on your side, that we are in some ways non or irrational as human beings, and we are drawn to conclusions through means other than reason. And so that, I would say parenthetically, one might take what Scott Adams is claiming and say that that's one of the reasons people are drawn to delusional takes on things. For example, one reason could be, and by the way, I know you're not favorable towards Scott Adams, but one reason some people appear to latch on to popular but diluted ideas is that they see all the influential people doing so. And I have a friend, Jeff Leskovar, who has a whole full-blown theory on this, that there are people who just cannot imagine not being part of the mainstream. Can't imagine not being part of the popular group.
Right.
And he says this goes back to times when people had to stay together in tribal groups. And if you have some dissenting voice, you ain't going to be no part of the tribe no more. And so it became a matter of survival that you just agree with whatever the herd says, and that has persisted down the ages. Do you think there's any plausibility to that?
Oh, absolutely I do. Actually, I don't develop that much in this particular collection, but it's something I've been thinking about a lot recently. And my view is something like this. When you're at school and they tell you certain things, like the capital of Portugal is Lisbon, or 2 + 2 = 4, there are two ways you can take that. You can take it as saying that it refers to something objective in external reality that happens to be true and that the teacher is fortunately telling you. Or you can take it that all that matters is that you agree with the teacher. And I think that most people on most things take the latter view. They think that what's really important is not to get it right in terms of objective fact, but to agree with the consensus. And of course, this enables them to get along and have a quiet life. Now, they can't practice this consistently. Like, if you want to know what time that bus leaves the station, you don't say, oh, I've heard two different views, so neither of them are true, or anything like that. You know that there is an objective fact, and that's independent of what anybody happens to be telling you, including, incidentally, the bus station, if you call them, because they can get it wrong. So people, in practical matters, people have a way of knowing that there is an objective truth. Whereas in anything that doesn't touch upon their concrete everyday life, they tend to think that there is no objective truth except to agree.
Let's talk, though, about the Scott Adams idea, because this has become quite fashionable to say. I hear it from quite a number of sources, that if you're going to try to reach people, long series of logical propositions isn't going to do it, or even a rational argument oftentimes isn't going to do it. So, for instance, if I want to object to the way public health carried out the COVID response, I ought to focus less on charts and graphs and more on stories of people who suffered under the restrictions. So you've heard this too. So what do you think's wrong with that? Is there something wrong with that?
Yes. Yes. Now, I think we have to allow a certain element of truth in it. And that is, you know, Aristotle wrote a book about logic, but he also wrote a book about persuasion called The Rhetoric. So there is such a thing as rhetoric, which is presenting arguments in a favorable light and getting them the maximum sympathy from your audience. So there are those two different things. But it seems to me that the latter does not abolish the former. In other words, there is an objective truth about any matter of fact. And most people don't develop this very much.
Well, let's think, though, about, for example, the Trump phenomenon. There are people who might very well change on a dime how they feel about certain people in politics. For example, Vivek Ramaswamy, whom for a few days or a couple of days, they didn't like him because Trump said not to like him, that he was suspicious and we should be wary of him. And then he invited Vivek on the stage with him and said he was a smart guy with a bright future. So then they liked him. Right. Or Ron DeSantis was a bad guy because he's Ron DeSanctimonious. But then he became Governor Ron DeSantis, and a really great guy, and I look forward to working with him. So, okay, so we like him. Now, not all Trump supporters are that way, and it's not just Trump who's guilty of this kind of thing, and it's more the supporters than the candidate. But I've seen people change on a dime, even though nothing about the facts of the matter have changed, just something like, well, this person told me to think this way, so I'll adopt it, and I'll think this way. That phenomenon seems to suggest there's something more than pure reason at work.
Right. Well, there are several things. I think one thing is that we accept theories, and these theories can never be, no theory can ever be completely validated. But we accept a theory, and sometimes very elaborate theories, and we tend to stick to our theories, in other words, believe in them, until there's a crisis in our beliefs. So that's one thing, and that I maintain is perfectly rational. That's a perfectly sensible thing to do. You shouldn't be too ready to abandon the theory that you've got so far for some very superficial counter-argument. So there is that. Now, if we take the case of Scott Adams, one of the things I point out is that He says there is no such thing as truth, or if there is, we're not equipped. You know, to quote the movie, we can't handle the truth, right? That's what Scott says. By the way, I do have a very high opinion of him, and I've learned a lot from him, but this is one area where I think he's hopeless. So one of the things I point out is that Scott Adams is constantly appealing to facts to support his arguments, constantly. I also point out there are many facts that become accepted across the board by everybody. Like, for example, everybody accepts that Trump became president in 2016. There is no substantial group of people saying that there'd been a coup d'etat by space aliens, and this was all pretense that Trump was in the White House, right? So there are certain things that just get accepted because the facts are overwhelming. And there are other things that don't get accepted. Another point I make is that a lot of the silliest things that people do when they're confronted with a challenge to their belief system is very temporary and makeshift. If you just look at a couple of months after some major development, people haven't had time to fully adjust. It's going to take years before they fully adjust. So some of these very crazy things are due to this short-term perspective that Scott tends to apply to political developments.
So if you're trying to convince somebody of the problems with Marxism, I mean, the thing is, I think I've been somewhat persuaded a bit by this whole thing, because I feel like if you look at our side of things, our side has produced enormous tomes and extraordinary treatises that to me are extremely well argued. They're elegant. They build a whole system that's very intellectually satisfying. And yet I have no confidence at all that if I continue to write treatises like this, it's going to make a bit of difference to anybody. And I guess after a while of observing that and seeing that, for example, now we have the internet. Now you don't have to rely on Dan Rather and the three television networks. Now you have everything at your fingertips.
Yes.
And almost nobody explores any of it. Now, that's not the same thing as being irrational, but it does say something, doesn't it?
Yes. I think online exchanges are in their infancy. And we haven't yet arrived at a point where every generation, every living generation, is fully accommodated to this kind of argument. And I think some of the problems we see are because only younger people are crowding into some of these areas of discourse, and older people tend to be underrepresented. And that will gradually take care of itself. Yeah, I mean, this idea that we're all irrational and we can't get at the truth, this is the predominant, at least in popular culture, this is the predominant view in our society. And it predates, really, Trump and Scott Adams. It predates those people. You know, there'd be people writing books saying that we're totally irrational for a long time. And I think there's something paradoxical about that, of course. You're writing a book to prove to people, objectively, that they're irrational. So there is a paradox there.
And no doubt there are paradoxes in the whole Scott Adams way of looking at things, because of the way he himself argues seems to contradict some of his claims. But when you talk about what you described as mass delusions or as substitute religions, let's say, so you talked about climate change, you talked about modern gender theory, things like this, and you have a discussion of this in the book. If it's not a question of human beings being irrational, how do we get into this situation where major things that the elites believe, and that by extension a great many average people believe, are false and destructively so?
Right. I think, you know, that with time, some of them will evaporate. And I think, you know, part of the problem is that we don't have much time for some of these things. But, I mean, I think that I would be amazed. Of course, I won't be around to be amazed. I'd be amazed if 40 years from today, anybody still believes that minute additions to the amount of atmospheric CO2 could possibly pose a serious threat to the human species. I don't think anybody will believe that in 40 years' time. In fact, I think there are a lot of things like that which they not only won't believe them, they won't believe you when you tell them that people used to believe this, because it's so utterly silly that they'll say, no, nobody really believed that.
Well, I feel like that's probably true in the extremely long run. When people look back on people wearing masks and they look like idiots and there's all this evidence that they obviously don't do anything, or people playing musical instruments through a hole in a mask or whatever.
Right.
People are going to have a hard time believing that anybody did that, or that people think that if I hang a small piece of plexiglass in front of where I'm standing, that no virus could get around it or whatever. Yeah, I think people will look at that and just be appalled or just incredulous at that. But I think that's 500 years from now. You think it's much sooner.
Well, I think it's 50 years or less. But it's true. I do actually tend to take the long view of some of these intellectual developments. You know the difference between an Englishman and an American. You've heard this.
I have not.
Okay. An Englishman is someone who thinks 100 miles is a long way. An American is someone who thinks 100 years is a long time.
That makes sense.
When I talk about, for example, I just whipped this out of the air, that if you have capitalism developing fairly lustily, like you do in China today, it's going to eventually cause an appetite for liberty. It's going to cause certain things to happen in society which lead to more liberty. People misunderstand me and think this is going to happen in the next 20 years, and I'm not saying that at all. But I think in 100 years it will happen, right? So I think the time scale is important.
Here's a quick message from our sponsor, Blinkist. In our day and age, we are faced with information overload, and I have an excellent way to deal with it. With the Blinkist app, you can absorb huge amounts of information in 27 nonfiction categories: history, philosophy, parenting, career, technology, religion, and on and on. Blinkist condenses each of thousands of different books into 15-minute summaries you can read or listen to. So if you have a half-hour commute each way, you can absorb the equivalent of 4 books. You think that might get a little information into the old noggin, make you a more impressive person? And among the thousands and thousands of titles at Blinkist, you'll also find libertarian classics by Murray Rothbard, Milton Friedman, and even a work by your host here, Tom Woods. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/Woods to start your 7-day free trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/Woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/Woods. And now for a limited time, you can even use Blinkist Connect to share your premium account. You'll get 2 premium subscriptions for the price of 1. Let's switch gears here, and I want to talk a bit about Marxism, because there's a sense in which it's still relevant, and there's a sense in which it isn't, in the sense that these days it obviously has morphed into something else. It's morphed into something Marx himself wouldn't have recognized. You don't hear really that many people talking about the economic ideas of Marxism or historical materialism. I mean, this all seems very passé. But nevertheless, a general worldview of oppressor and oppressed, in which there is a bright future in which the oppressors get what's coming to them, that's still very much alive. But
yes.
You have a chapter saying that regardless of all that, just because of the nature of Marxism itself, it is impossible, as you say, for there ever to be a Marxist revolution. Now, how is that?
Right. So I'm talking about a revolution as Marx conceived it, and as all the early Marxists up until 1917 conceived it. I think that's strictly impossible. It's impossible for 2 reasons. Well, there's 1 fundamental reason and 1 derivative reason. The fundamental reason is that the kind of society that Marx thought would emerge after capitalism cannot actually exist. And there are several reasons for that. And I have this article where I talk about 2 of them, in particular Mises' economic calculation argument, which basically the bottom line there is that if you want an industrial society which is able to give the masses high living standards, then you must have a price system, and it must be a fully functioning price system that conveys information. And that means you need private property, because you can't have a proper pricing of assets without private property. So that's 1 thing. The other reason I give is the very interesting Mikel's argument that in any big organization, there's going to be leadership, and the bigger the organization, the more complex the organization, the bigger the gulf between the leaders and the mass of the members, so to speak. So Marx thought of communism as being a very completely democratic system, contrary to what you might think with what happened later in Marxism, Marx didn't think that communism would be ruled by a party or an elite of any kind. It was very much a kind of, very similar to anarcho-communism, except in the transitional phase. But that's completely impossible, and it's impossible for organizational reasons, because Marx is also committed to what was called a single vast plan. You know, that's an actual quote from Marx's close friend Engels in Anti-During, that this was what would replace capitalism. You see, Marx and Engels had, they saw that there were bigger and bigger companies in the marketplace, bigger and bigger corporations. And then they saw the beginning of the trusts movement, which actually was a bit bogus, because most of these trusts were very short-lived, and most of them weren't able to actually cartelize the industries that they tried to cartelize. But still, they thought that everything was organizationally getting on a bigger and bigger scale. And therefore, the ultimate would be one big organization governing everything, but which would be under democratic control. Well, I think we can see today, first of all, that hasn't happened. It's had plenty of time to happen. Secondly, it's not being approached. A lot of Marxists still think it is being approached because they notice there are gigantic corporations. But the point is, there are many more small firms as well as those gigantic corporations. And in fact, the gigantic corporations need an environment of many small firms in order to exist. So we're not actually moving towards fewer and fewer firms or fewer and fewer companies. There's no sign of that whatsoever. And secondly, it can't happen, because if it did happen, there'd be no price system, because there'd be no independent, autonomous entities. But then if you add to that the requirement that Marx would have insisted on, that it all has to be democratic and under the control of the people, you see that that's based on a kind of fairy tale notion of democracy. You know, when you get a big organization, it's always run by a few people. That's what Michel's pointed out. Everybody owning everything means nothing, because the people who actually control and therefore own in a realistic sense are going to be a tiny handful. And that's inescapable because of the nature of organizations.
But it's also inescapable because the idea of ownership implies control over something. And I obviously can't get the consent of 500,000 people, let's say, every time I want to use something. Now, and I grant you, we're not talking about consumer goods here. So I don't mean that I have to ask 500,000 people if I can use my toothbrush or not. But nevertheless, how could I run an operation if it's collectively owned? That means everybody has a say in what I can and can't do with it.
Right.
So in practice, it means some people will make the decisions.
Yes, yes. In practice, it means that a handful of people will make the decisions, or if not one person. But that's absolutely true, and it should be clear. And I think if you take a very long view, and here it comes back to the Englishman's view, then you see that this has grudgingly and gradually been accepted. I grew up in a world where there was the Soviet Union, there was the People's Republic of China. They all claimed to be socialist systems, which were trying to plan everything and were moving towards what they called full communism. Now, both China and Russia are completely and utterly capitalist in their organization. And as a result, they've become rich and successful. And there are a few holdouts, like in Venezuela and North Korea, where people still have these ideas of closer to the notion of a single vast plan. But generally speaking, it's disappeared. And one of the points I make, actually, in a couple of places in this book, is that a lot of pessimists will look at what's going on and they will say, oh, the left has got bigger and bigger. And in a sense, that's true. But the left, the views of the left are more wishy-washy than they used to be. They talk about injustice and gender and race. Very rarely meet a leftist today who will say the government ought to nationalize everything tomorrow morning. But that was quite commonplace 60, 70 years ago. When I was forming my political attitude 60 or 70 years ago, that was a very commonplace view, and it's largely disappeared. What's replaced it, in some ways, is even more horrifying, you know, with transgenderism and cutting off the genitals of little kids and all that kind of stuff. You know, we're living in this insane nightmare world. But in practice, they have conceded that the kind of socialism that used to be proposed back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, that nobody's proposing it anymore. It's gone.
again, if you just given the nature of a book of essays, I want to switch gears yet again, because we've got to talk about Sam Harris. And in particular, I want to read a passage of his that you have in your book on page 111 and try to unpack this here. He says, "Some propositions are so dangerous that it may even be ethical to kill people for believing them. This may seem an extraordinary claim, but it merely enunciates an ordinary fact about the world in which we live. Certain beliefs place their adherents beyond the reach of every peaceful means of persuasion, while inspiring them to commit extraordinary acts of violence against others. There is, in fact, no talking to some people. If they cannot be captured, and they often cannot, otherwise tolerant people may be justified in killing them in self-defense." Now you, David Ramsey Steele, have a little something to say about this, it turns out.
Yes. Yes. Well, there are lots of things to be said, and I actually dealt with him quite gently and tried to hold his hand and reason with him in that particular chapter. You see, if you put this in context, 2004, Sam Harris came from nowhere and had a huge hit, the book, The End of Faith. And although it seems at first, now, there are different levels to that book and there are different levels to its impact. An important part of the impact of the book was that it enabled leftist intellectuals, leftist intellectuals today would mostly despise Sam Harris, but at the time, 2004, it enabled leftist intellectuals to have a way of coming to terms with 9/11, which they had found embarrassing because 9/11 called for an automatic response that they didn't like, which was to be patriotic and to blame foreigners for something that had happened, right? Whereas the left, of course, worships foreigners and anything that's anti-American and so on. So it enabled a lot of leftist intellectuals to come to terms. So basically, the argument was Osama bin Laden is the same as Jerry Falwell, right? So the enemy is religion. And religion leads to people killing and mass murder. So that's one level that's going on there. The other thing is, and it's very strange how this was not commented upon at the time more frequently, is that basically there is an underlying message here that Islam is uniquely evil, much more so than Christianity or Judaism. And it's uniquely evil because of suicide bombing. And suicide bombing occurs because the Quran says you've got to kill the infidel, and only for that reason. Now, there are many odd things about this claim. Of course, there is the fact that prior to 1981, there were no Muslim suicide bombers whatsoever, right? None. So the idea that people got this by reading the Quran is there's something strange. Then, of course, you might say, well, you know, the West has been bombing Arabs and other Islamic populations, you know, massacring tens of thousands of them from time to time. Maybe that's got something to do with it. Maybe this helps to account for what happened. But of course, no, that couldn't possibly. What could the connection be? So there is that.
But stop right there for a minute, though, because as you were saying, you could see how 9/11 puts people in this, especially people on the left, in this particularly weird position because they like criticizing their own civilization. That's their favorite pastime. They don't want to criticize anybody else. But they could have, with the line of argument that you're making here, they could have said, well, maybe they might not put it quite so crudely, but, well, we had it coming to us for the things we were doing to them. And a lot of them, the establishment left, just wouldn't go down that road.
Right.
They became Sam Harris.
Right. Well, you know, that kind of left, of course, talking about the left is always hazardous because there's so many different facets and different factions. But there is always the more consistent left, like Noam Chomsky, and the rather inconsistent left, which combines a kind of leftist veneer with a general approval of big government and anything it does, big American government and anything it does. So there is that. And of course, the latter numerically preponderates. The closer you get to Washington, D.C., the more they preponderate. And when you get to Washington, D.C., you find they regard themselves as rulers of the world. So there are these different facets of the left. But the other thing is that this has been pointed out, and Sam Harris has attempted to respond to it totally unconvincingly. But in the years, like the 10 or 20 years after 9/11, the biggest suicide bombers were the Tamil Tigers from Sri Lanka.
Marxists.
Who were atheists.
Yeah.
They were atheists. They were Marxists. They were totally opposed to theistic religion. They had Hindu backgrounds, but they weren't Hindus by conviction, or at least they wouldn't admit to it. So they were the biggest organization, and they account for, over those years, they account for more than a quarter of all suicide bombings. And then there is the fact that, yeah, and then of course we owe a lot to Robert Pape and his research into suicide bombings. So Robert Pape and his associates produced two books, and that what they did, they compiled a database of all suicide bombings. And they found that a huge number of suicide bombings were conducted by atheists and secularists, and also by Christians. And it's clear from what Sam Harris says that he had no... You see, Sam Harris didn't study Islam. He didn't spend a couple of weekends boning up on Islam. He just listened to the news and he thought, oh, yes, they're bombing these suicide bombers. They need the attentions of 72 virgins after they've shuffled off this mortal coil. And therefore, they're convinced of that, and that makes them suicide bombers. So what Pape showed, and I think it's shown very conclusively because they analyze all the suicide bombings that have ever been recorded, is that suicide bombings overwhelmingly are the resistance of and the hitting back of a militarily weak ethnic population that perceives itself as being under foreign occupation. That's the explanation for suicide bombings. But I raise a few other points in the chapter. And one of them is that in all national cultures, there has been a great praise, great sanctity, great approval of giving up your life for your side in the, for your country or your monarch or for whatever, give it for your side in some inter-ethnic conflict. This goes back. And when I was a kid growing up in the 1950s, I often heard preachers in Britain quote the line from Jesus, greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends, right? And that was meant to say the people who died in the war was, and of course, a lot of the Germans they killed were Christians. So that, you know, that sort of thing never interferes with these people. But yeah, so the idea that there's something highly meritorious in dying deliberately in the pursuit of war against the enemy is very, very commonplace. Very, very commonplace. It's no, there's nothing, and it's not particularly, doesn't have deep roots in Islam at all. And you have various examples of suicide attacks throughout history. And I mentioned some of them, you know, that you could compile a huge list of suicide attacks. And of course, although it's probably not historical, you have the example of Samson, you know, who pulled the pillars together and caused this building to collapse, killing 3,000 Philistines, men, women, and children. And, you know, so you could say, that was a prophecy of 9/11 where 3,000 people killed. But anyway, by suicide. But so Samson committed suicide with the Lord's approval as long as he took with him 3,000 Philistines. So there is this strain. And then there are all these anarchists in the 19th century who bombed and killed people. They were nearly all atheists. And they did it for various reasons. But anyway, they weren't Muslims. That's my point. So there is a whole history of this kind of thing. And it's not surprising that Osama bin Laden produced all these videos. I haven't watched any great number of them, but these videos were produced to recruit young Arabs, right? They didn't have the intention of persuading the West. They had the intention of recruiting people. And it's quoted in one of Pape's books, that Osama bin Laden said, well, you know, these people keep saying we want to destroy freedom, and that's why we have these attacks on the United States. Well, why don't we attack Sweden? Why don't we attack Canada? You know, it's got nothing to do with that. It's because we're promoting our freedom and our freedom from foreign occupation, to wit, in this particular case, Israeli occupation with the backing of the United States and underwritten and made possible, enabled by the United States. So, you know, now, we can look at that and say, yeah, it's still terrible and you shouldn't be doing it. You know, if you want to look at it morally, you can say it's terrible to kill innocent people, even though, but you shouldn't misrepresent the motives of people who do this. They're not saying it says in the Quran to kill the infidel. In fact, Muslims accept that you don't go around indiscriminately killing infidels. that's accepted by the vast majority of Muslims, nearly all of them, I would say. But this is a political conflict, and it's an interethnic conflict.
Hey, folks, a word from our sponsor, Bank on Yourself. Are you being lied to? Wall Street tells you to put your money in an IRA or 401k. Yet studies show the average American who follows that advice will outlive his savings by 10 years. Bank on Yourself is a better way to grow and protect your hard-earned money. This retirement plan alternative has never had a losing year in over 160 years. With Bank on Yourself, your plan doesn't go backward when the markets tumble. Your principal and growth are locked in. You'll know what your tax rate will be in retirement, zero under current tax law, which protects you from the coming tax tsunami. You're in control. You get access to your money for any purpose with no questions asked and without government penalties or restrictions on how much income you can take or when you can take it. Try doing that with a 401k or IRA. Do you want guaranteed, predictable annual growth, control of your money, and tax-free retirement income? Then go to bankonyourself.com/woods, and we'll send you a free report with the proven retirement plan alternative that banks and Wall Street are desperately hoping you never hear about. Just go to bankonyourself.com/woods for your free report. bankonyourself.com/woods. I think the other topic I want to make sure we get to, because we've talked about it, you and I, before, and you've written quite a bit on it, is the subject of George Orwell. Now, here's somebody, because of the literary work he produced, you would think would be, inoculated against, let's say, being swayed to a particular position on the basis of something other than strict reason. But you say in your chapter here, intellectuals may almost be defined as people who can easily be convinced of fanciful dogmas concerning matters of which they are comprehensively ignorant. So you say, Orwell was firmly convinced that capitalism was in its final throes and could be replaced only by some form of collectivism. He was convinced of this on grounds of economics and industrial organization, though he knew absolutely nothing of economics or industrial organization. It is astonishing to me that somebody like this, who did believe that collectivism was inevitable for whatever reason, could nevertheless write in ways that are so striking about the dangers of collectivism and not, I mean, surely he must have seen some tension there.
Well, I think the problem is Orwell took the view, and this is the thing. I mean, most people accept certain things and go through their life and never question them. And Orwell was converted to socialism from being an anti-socialist in the year 1936. As he got more and more into it, he became more and more convinced of socialism. And he not only believed that socialism was a good idea, he believed that it was absolutely inevitable, that capitalism was doomed. This is a very central conviction of Orwell. Now, it's possible that if he'd lived, he died at the age of 46 January 1950, at the age of 46. If he'd lived to be 76, I think there's a good chance he would have become pro-capitalist. But, you know, so Orwell often had good things to say about laissez-faire capitalism, or as he would say it, the lost world of before 1910, you know, that world. He thought there were lots of good things about it, and he was nostalgic for it. But he heard so many people who were supposed to be qualified economists telling him that capitalism was doomed, that it was in its final throes of its death agony. And he believed that. He believed that from 1936 until his death. At least there is no indication that he ever said anything to question it. So this is Orwell's fixed view. Now, Orwell thought, the view he took and the view he defended was collectivism is going to replace capitalism. There's nothing we can do about it. And to talk about reviving capitalism is absolutely silly. Orwell reviewed The Road to Serfdom in 1944. And he said, so it's all very well to say. And this is where Orwell is a slick user of words. He's a very good persuasive writer. And he says, Orwell says, the trouble with competitions is that somebody wins them. That's supposed to be, Orwell regarded that as a resounding sort of riposte to anybody who wanted to talk about free market capitalism. Yeah, you know, but of course, it's not true. And many people may win, And even if one person wins, they're not going to win permanently. So Orwell had this view. So then the view he took was, there are two ways that collectivism can develop. It can either be what he called oligarchical collectivism, meaning totalitarianism, meaning something like Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union. Or it can be democratic collectivism, in which we'll have a collectivist system where everybody works for the government. As Orwell repeatedly said, in socialism, everybody works for the government. Everybody's a government employee, and the government owns everything. That's socialism, as he saw it. This is the socialism of the 20s and 30s. It wasn't like wishy-washy socialism, like came along later, mixed economy or any of that stuff. So Orwell said, okay, we're going to have this system where the government owns everything, everybody's a government employee, and there is democracy and approximately equal incomes. That was his conception of socialism. He said, now, we can either have, collectivism can take two forms. It can either take the form of oligarchical collectivism, like Soviet Russia or 1984, or it can take the form of democratic socialism, which is like, oh, come to think of it, there aren't any examples yet. So this was his view. And he actually stated on a few occasions, two or three occasions, he stated, it's possible that we're just doomed, that democratic socialism can't exist. And he wrote something suggesting that the only future for us all is totalitarianism. And one thing about my researches on Orwell is, there are all kinds of surprising things you've done up. And one is that the term totalitarianism was very well in use by the late 20s. And it was among people who read political journals and that kind of people, intellectuals. It was extremely commonplace term with different meanings in different groups. But anyway, so he says, it's possible that we're faced with totalitarianism and there is no other future. And somebody wrote to him, Victor Gallant wrote to him and said, well, do you really think this? And he wrote back saying, well, maybe I was a bit too pessimistic. Maybe there's a chance for democracy to survive the abolition of capitalism. We won't know, this is what he says, we won't know until a country with strong liberal traditions introduces a socialist system. So at the end of his life, he was a very strong supporter of the Labour government. And people sometimes need reminding that the Labour government, which came into power in 1945, nationalized a fifth of the British economy in a couple of years. And at the time when they were doing this, they said, this is the first step. Now, later on, of course, the experience of those nationalized industries wasn't great. And they started backtracking and saying, oh, no, mixed economy. Whether a business is state-owned or privately owned is to be judged on its merits. And we mustn't woodenly press ahead with nationalizing everything. But there was that period where they came to power in 1945 in a landslide, although they got less than 50% of the vote, but it was because of the electoral system. It was a landslide in Parliament. And they pushed through a lot of things. One of the things they pushed through was something we should be eternally grateful for, and that is independence for India. And thank goodness we might have had an earlier version of Vietnam if Winston Churchill had got his way and the British had made a stand in India. I can't imagine what a nightmare that would be. So the Labour government did one wonderful thing. They got out of India and a few other places. But they had this view that the first step in introducing socialism was to nationalize what they called the commanding heights of industry. So steel, the railways and all this, all these really crucial basic industries, they nationalized. So this was the spirit of the times. And we don't know how Orwell would have reacted later. But of course, one of the points that actually Hayek makes and Orwell overlooked, because Orwell said, oh, we won't know how it's going to turn out until a country with really strong liberal traditions introduces socialism. Well, the one thing he didn't actually bargain with is that they lose their liberal traditions just because they're introducing this big sort of succubus of the state controlling everything. That's going to get rid of the liberal traditions. So that's the world that I was born into in 1944, was a welfare state and a huge element of industry nationalized. But then people wised up a bit in Britain and they gave up the pursuit of total government ownership.
Does all this, the various topics that you cover in this book, does it make you misanthropic? And if not, why not?
No, it makes me sad about the future of the human species and dubious about how it's all going to turn out. But it doesn't make me hate the human species. I quite like humans. I mean, at a distance, I don't want to be too close to too many of them. No, I'm in favor of humankind, and I want to see them happy and flourishing. But I'm not misanthropic at all. Except towards certain people who preach certain ideas.
Right. I mean, even though an absolutely mind-boggling number of them make me crazy, in my experience, still, the good ones, for me, outweigh. They may not outnumber, but they outweigh the bad ones.
Right. Well, you know, human beings evolved in packs. Therefore, it's reasonable to suppose that they have a genetic tendency to agree with the pack. Solidarity is important. And this can easily, by the imagination, be transferred to a pack of millions, even though it's really a bit absurd to do that. And so you have this susceptibility of human beings to the contagion of mass delusions, like Lysenkoism, but also in democratic countries. You know, I have this three examples of the low-fat diet, the global warming catastrophism, and the COVID crimes, both the lockdowns and the vaccines, these three holocausts which killed millions of people. And if you watch people's behavior, it's absolutely staggering to see the behavior of people go along with this, like sheep to the slaughter. And it's due to many things. As I point out, one of the things is the worship of science, because that has now replaced old-time religion, and the government control of science, because the vast majority, 99% of government, of scientific research is funded by the government. And this means that the bureaucrats who dispense the funds look for things that are relevant in their mind rather than things which are objectively interesting from a scientific point of view. And relevant in their minds mean whatever ideological tsunami is brushing through people's brains at that point. So that leads to these horrible outrages. And that certainly, I can see why some people would despair.
Well, let's close by directing people to either tomwoods.com/2444, or if you're watching on video in the description of the video, for the link to the book we've been talking about, which is The Conquistador with His Pants Down, David Ramsey Steele's Legendary Lost Lectures. You know, we can't finish this conversation, and any other media you do for this, you're going to get the same thing. You have to justify that title. Can you do that quickly before we wrap up?
Oh, well, it comes from the chapter about Sigmund Freud. Sigmund Freud wrote to his friend Wilhelm Fliess, said, "I'm not really a scientist, I'm a conquistador." And my chapter on Freud, I show that he was thoroughly dishonest in the way he reported his cases. And he said that all these people told him that they'd been seduced, as he put it, by their parents, by their fathers. Actually, not a single one of them ever told him that. This is just untrue. But he was using told originally in a metaphorical sense, meaning I could tell from their symptoms that they had been seduced by their fathers. But later on, he saw that people were taking it literally, and he played this up. So people who read Freud, and I read Freud back in the 60s, and I was impressed, you know, that all these patients told him that they'd been seduced by their fathers. But if you read it carefully, and if you look at it, this has been deconstructed by a number of people. If you look at his original notes and the first drafts of when he talked about these cases, originally he says that the patients never believed this and you had to convince them of it. And he used to browbeat and harangue his patients saying, "No, you were seduced by your father. No, no, I can't remember that." Well, it happened. And whether any of them ever swallowed this and agreed is still uncertain. But this went out to the world as the message that these patients had reported this to Freud. Well, not one of them reported it to Freud. This was Freud's interpretation of their symptoms. And so psychoanalysis, I don't suppose it's done as much harm as Marxism because it didn't get political power, but it is an example of this modern religion, which claims to be scientific, is actually totally pseudoscientific and one bare examination, but which captures the imagination of millions of people who think it's scientific, and that's their religion. And religions like this, psychoanalysis is now dying quickly, but religions like this are extremely vigorous. They're strong, they're powerful, whereas religions like Christianity and Islam in the modern industrialized world are very feeble. And so they give way to these scientific religions. And the scientific religions are really, really dangerous. And so, the practical steps to alleviate this problem, I would say the biggest is stop the government funding of science. You know, there is a guy, what's his name, who's written about this and shows that...
Oh, Terence Keeley.
Yeah, that's right.
One of the best episodes of the Tom Woods Show ever was when I talked to him.
What a brilliant guy. Yeah, and it shows that just purely from a scientific point of view, it'd be far better to get the government out of funding science and allow it to be funded voluntarily. And then some of these problems would go away.
Well, from your lips to God's ear, let's use that old expression. Well, David Ramsey Steele, author of The Conquistador with His Pants Down, thank you very much.
You're welcome, and I'm very grateful to have this opportunity. Thanks.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.